Welcome to The Jewish Diasporist, a podcast exploring the political, social, and cultural implications of life in diaspora. We are your hosts, Zach Smerin
and Ben Yanowitz. For this episode, we interviewed Naomi Sederman, director of the Center for Diaspora and Transnational Studies at the University of Toronto in Ontario, Canada, and a scholar and educator whose work sits at the intersections of translation studies, Jewish studies, and more.
Personally, I first met Naomi in Vienna when she happened to be giving a talk on Beis Yaakov, the school system established for Hasidic girls in Eastern Europe in the early 20th century. While we won't be discussing this subject in today's episode, it goes to show Naomi's broad interest in and significant understanding of diasporic Jewish life. We will return to the subject of Jewish youth education very soon.
Throughout this episode, we explore the history and content of the academic field of diaspora studies. Where does it come from? How can it relate to or inform our understanding of diasporism as a political perspective?
As you've probably noticed, we have slowed down from our previously bi-weekly episode schedule. For the time being, we will continue to publish on a slower release pattern, but we remain committed to bringing you critical conversations with insightful guests.
Without any further ado, we hope you enjoy this conversation.
We are beautiful people, though our hearts are broken, we sing for justice and wholeness.
Naomi, it's great to have you on here. Thank you very much. It's great to be back in some way. I haven't recorded an episode in quite some time. But just before we get into the meat of the substance, the kosher meat of the substance, I assume, Naomi, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and what has brought you to where you are today?
Wow, what has brought me to today? There's a lot of background here. So I grew up in a Hasidic Yiddish-speaking home in Brooklyn, and I left the Orthodox world when I was 18. I'm not really sure like what part of where I am today I should be answering, but I'll just assume it's how I became a diaspora studies scholar. And I took advantage of my knowledge of Yiddish to study. They didn't teach Yiddish at the universities I went to when I was a student, but I just faked my German using Yiddish. So I took a lot of German, and I got 3 degrees in comparative literature. And when I was about halfway through my PhD, I saw a poster up on the wall that said Yiddish summer program, and they actually paid money, which was the main thing for me at the time. So $3,000, which was a lot of money. And I was like, oh, okay. So I went to the Yiddish Book Center and I worked there for the summer. And that was when I realized that my knowledge of Yiddish wasn't just a way for me to like fake knowledge of German, but actually a kind of desirable skill that I hadn't even known I had. I actually wasn't fluent anymore by the time I figured this out. But compared to everybody else at the Yiddish Book Center, all the other interns that could barely read the Aleph Beis, I was a whiz. It's like discovering that you have some special gift that other people don't have. And I turned on a dime, and instead of writing about German, I was going to write about the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible for my dissertation. My dissertation topic became the sexual politics of Hebrew and Yiddish, Hebrew as the kind of masculine dimension, facet of Ashkenazic Jewishness, and Yiddish as the more feminine side, if you want to call it that. And that was my first book. It became my first book, and it kind of it set me on the path of looking at the relationship between languages. From there, my second book, which really started by my thinking about the difference between the Yiddish and the French version of Elie Wiesel's Night, which was something I wrote about when I was still a graduate student. And I started thinking about the ways that Jews speak differently among themselves versus how they speak when they're in earshot of non-Jews. So kind of hidden languages, private languages, languages of Jewish intimacy. And that sort of set me on the path of being a translation studies person. I got really involved in the field of translation studies. That led me into all kinds of crazy places. Like for a while, I was spending time with Christian missionaries who were translating the Bible I'm more interested in my work of thinking through what's the difference between Christian and Jewish approaches to translation. And then in 2013, Diaspora Studies, I guess I was writing a little bit about diaspora in the context of writing about translation. I have an old essay I wrote a long time ago called Diaspora and Translation, The Migrations of Meaning. And that's all I remember, so don't ask me any more about that, is the title. So I've been thinking along these ways, and then I got an offer to be a visiting scholar, visiting professor at University of Toronto in 2013. And Jewish Studies was bringing me, but there isn't really exactly a Jewish Studies program. It's more like a collaborative program. You have to be in a different department. And there was a Center for Diaspora and Transnational Studies run by a pretty amazing diasporist, I guess you could call him, named Otto Quezon, who studies Ghanaian literature, so African literature, but has a serious interest in Yiddish literature, too. He invited me to teach a class at the Center for Diaspora and Transnational Studies, DTS, and I taught a class called Going Astray, Diaspora and Translation. And that's how I got involved in DTS. And then I was hired as a tenured faculty member at University of Toronto. And my two departments were Diaspora and Religious Studies. And just starting less than a month ago, you know, I became the director of the Center for Diaspora and Transnational Studies.
What is diaspora studies in this context? Because you talk about it from your background in translation studies. And yes, of course, that's connected when you think about people speaking different languages in the same context. But what else is included in diaspora studies and translation?
The diaspora studies, it starts in the 90s. Those are when the big journals come out and suddenly it becomes conceptualized as a field. I mean, there were people who used the term diaspora, obviously, in their research. The basic idea is that the university is organized according to the nation state. If you're studying literature, are you studying French literature? Are you studying English literature? Are you studying German literature? If you're in history, are you studying French history? Are you studying which continent? What's your area of focus? And this particular way of organizing our systems of knowledge have become more and more obsolete. I mean, the world is on the move. And to act as if the nation state is not only the basic political structure, but also the basic intellectual academic structure, misses a lot. It misses other ways of organizing human society. It misses the phenomenon of a culture that is living in one part of the world, but has memory ties or cultural affiliations, or however you describe it, with a different place on the globe. It was founded by various people in various departments at the University of Toronto, but Otto Quezon was the first director. And for him, it was very interesting to think about things like the African diaspora in Toronto, or, you know, the global spread of evangelical Christianity, all these dimensions of the world, either from, you know, the anthropological perspective or the historical or the economic perspective. We have a labor historian. When you think about any of those things, you're in the realm where the nation state isn't going to tell you the whole story. As an academic field, diaspora studies was really important as a kind of interdiscipline. So we don't have our own graduate students, but we have graduate students who have diasporic interests, if you want to call it, from all kinds of departments, you know, history and literature and poli-sci and economics, etc. We similarly offer a range of classes, and then we have our own majors and minors. And these are people who really want to understand what diaspora is from many different perspectives. History and anthropology, because of the way the field developed, we were mostly modernists. We got our first Bible scholar last year. So we have somebody teaching the Bible and diaspora, which is funny because you think of the Jewish diaspora as being post-biblical, but it's not. It sets the stage in some way for thinking about diaspora, which is one of my present research projects.
I was just kind of wanting to reflect on the rise of diaspora studies as a specific discipline in the 90s, because when I was doing my master's research, I found that the first references to diasporism as like a political orientation was in the mid to late 90s. So I guess I'm kind of wondering if you have any thoughts on why it was the 90s that we start to see this reorientation from focuses on like national histories to this wider approach to understanding transnational connections.
So the 90s, it's interesting because the 90s was also the period when translation studies really got off the ground too. It's interesting. I was a graduate student in the 80s and I left graduate school for a while, as people tend to do. I used to joke I was a gradual student. When I came back, it was a totally different atmosphere and totally different environment. And one of the ways of thinking about it was that in the 80s, in American literature programs, which I was in at Berkeley, it was very dominated by what's called post-structuralism, Derrida, etc. This real focus on the text and on language and meaning. When I came back in the 90s, suddenly it was like political. We were in a different kind of mood. Reality, which had been sort of put in quotes in the 80s with all this focus on the text, the meaning, and what is reality, suddenly we were talking about things like, you know, politics and, you know, Edward Said's Orientalism made a huge impact. And, you know, that book was written earlier, but race, and maybe I'll give an example from translation studies. So
sure.
Translation studies, like Derrida, asks the question of where is meaning located? It's like, where is the language in which you can decide if a translation is accurate? This is a kind of Derridean question, right? If you have two languages and one is supposed to be the equivalent of another, where is the space above language that can guarantee that these have anything to do with each other? If you're speaking different languages, how do they connect to each other? This is a kind of philosophical question about language and meaning, which was important in translation studies kind of in a slightly earlier period. And now in diaspora studies, when I teach diaspora studies, like the first week I had a session called Translating Gaza. In other words, the question of the asymmetry of languages, the question of the ways in which they speak to each other, this fantasy that languages exist as if in a bilingual dictionary where, you know, this equals this. We don't think that way in translation studies anymore. We're talking about asymmetries. What does it mean for an Israeli journalist to go into Gaza? What does it mean for a Palestinian to speak across that line to Jews throughout the world? So those are the kinds of questions about the relationships between languages that became important and interesting in the 1990s. So there's a real, I don't know what to call it, politicization of the field. Diaspora has like two dimensions. On the one hand, it's an academic field of study. It's not like you walk into a seminar and the teacher is going to tell you that the nation state is bad, refugees are good, or whatever diasporism might imply. It'll be a kind of like, how does diaspora navigate different kinds of political situations? How do diaspora communities? And then the big question of how to define diaspora, which is one of the interesting things about the field, is that the very definition of diaspora has itself been kind of deconstructed over the last 10, 15 years and dramatically changed from the way it was considered in the 90s.
One thing I wanted to talk about is now with this question of, you know, what is described as lost in translation or differences that come from different understandings and linguistic structures, also connected now with this matter of crossing boundaries and migration that diaspora is rooted in. You mentioned this matter of translation of being kind to the stranger that comes from the Bible. It is now being very thematic given the ever-increasing levels of discussion that migration and migrants have. We've seen in the last 10 days or so since recording this, various far-right rallies across Poland, so-called border patrols attacking suspected or perceived migrants, one in Vienna here just a few days ago. And so I wanted to mention this case that you brought up because it's rooted alongside this, on one hand, academic or linguistic discourse, and on the other, very much rooted in the current geopolitical reality. So I'd be very keen for you to share your thoughts and ideas on that regard.
So like a lot of academics, I think I've been feeling more and more pressure to speak up, to speak out. And then the other hand, what do I have to say? I'm not a political scientist. I'm somebody who just read a lot of books. That's why my eyesight and my posture are so bad. So I was thinking about what I can contribute to the discourse right now on immigration, particularly in the United States rather than Europe. And the reason why particularly in the United States is because there's a biblical dimension to the argument about migrants in the United States that I think might be lacking in other places, because the evangelical right is so involved in the debate around immigration, and because Jews are so prominent on the left, for various reasons, whatever the reason, or maybe the ways in which the Bible is really imbricated into American political discourse. As a translation studies scholar, I'm sort of trained to notice translation. And when I say to notice translation, translation is often elided or forgotten. You know, people talk about, if English was good enough for Jesus, then why isn't it? You know, in other words, the translational character of the Bible is often ignored because people want to give it this authority. And once you say, is that what it really says in the Hebrew or the Greek? Then suddenly you're on shaky ground, and we can't have that. We can't have shaky ground when it comes to the Bible. So having a focus on translation is itself a kind of intervention, political, not only academic intervention, into a field where people are claiming all kinds of authority about a book that they don't have access to in the original language. And now, what is the original language, even when you talk about the New Testament? Translation studies is relevant here. But I came up with this idea of writing about the phrase, be kind to the stranger, for you are a stranger in the land of Egypt, after seeing people holding this sign at pro-immigration rallies in New York, you know, during the first Trump administration. I was like, it's interesting when people carry the sign in Hebrew, because they know that most people in New York can't read it in Hebrew. So they're making some kind of implicit statement just by using a language. So what is that implicit statement? And then when they do use a translation, what's the translation? And then I started thinking, so is it be kind to the stranger, be kind to the sojourner? I've seen alien. There's another dimension of translation. Once I started thinking about it, it just seemed like a very translational move, because basically for two reasons. It just is like, the more I thought about it, the more it unfolded, because they're making an implicit translational argument by saying, you know, this text that was written in the ancient world thousands of years ago, supposedly from God, if you believe that, somehow is exactly relevant to us today, which is to say it's a kind of translation from one era to another. And then I thought about that, you know, is God still saying that to us? What does that mean? What are you implying? And then the other thing I started thinking about is that it itself, in the, let's say, the original Hebrew, so there are many verses in the Bible that this refers to, lo tilchatz et hager, ki atem yadatem et lev hager, ki gerim hayitem be'eretz Mitzrayim, is one, I think it's in Leviticus somewhere. I know I should know the Bible by heart, but do not oppress the stranger or the ger, as if we know what ger means. You know, we pretend. Translators often don't quite understand what a word means. Lo tuchatz et hager, be kind to the stranger, because you know the heart of the stranger, right? The Bible doesn't often talk about this kind of whatever sympathy, because you were a stranger in the land of Egypt. That translational logic of where I was then, now I'm in a different position, but I see other people who are in the position I was in before. In other words, in the Bible, there's already this engine that ends up being the land of Egypt to the Jew, I guess, the Israelite in the land of Israel, dealing with immigrants to the land of Israel, to the Jew in the United States who came through Ellis Island, to the Mexican border. In other words, there's just many cycles. And the other thing I noticed that meant a lot to me is that we don't know what ger means. There's all kinds of biblical debates about, you know, stranger, sojourner, alien. On the evangelical right, they say it means a legal alien as opposed to an illegal alien, which is a different word. Let's say that the uncertainty around the meaning of language, which we inherit from Derrida and other philosophers, is certainly there. The one thing that no translation misses is that the word ger, or X, let's call it X, I was an X, so I should be kind to the person who is now an X. Whatever X means, if you have alien, then you have alien. If you have sojourner, then you have sojourner. It's as if the Bible evades the vagaries of translation. It's as if in those verses, the writer of the Bible grabs you by the lapel and says, you cannot miss this thing, which is a principle of sympathy and equality. Whatever the words mean, I will repeat them enough so that the rhyme is reason, right? The ethical principle is embedded in the language, and cannot be uprooted, because you have to look a word up in the dictionary. It doesn't matter what the word is. It's you as in one position of the hierarchy and the other in the other position of the hierarchy. You are interchangeable in some ethical system, which is the basis of this religion. I spend a lot of time thinking about this particular verse, and I could go on about it, but you know, one day I'll write a book just about this verse and how it functions in political discourse and how it's changed. I'm sure you know that the word ger in rabbinic Judaism means a convert. Words do not stand still, which is why it's so interesting that in this case, the translators get one aspect of it right. So I'm interested in how it is that words don't stand still, and I'm interested in how they come back to be meaningful at certain moments of human history. And we're in one right now, so I have to hurry up and finish this book.
It's been a little while since the concept of ger has been looked into on our podcast. If I remember correctly, we have to go back to Rabbi David Cooper on episode 7 or 8.
Something like that, yeah. I know he's definitely spoken a lot about it in terms of thinking as, he described it as the inner outsider, like someone that is a stranger but is also with you and has a sense of belonging. I thought what you just said about the schema of like, you were this and now you have to be kind of this. It's one of those things where even if you were to translate it incorrectly, it still has the message being the same. And I hadn't thought about how that really does show the importance of it. Because I mean, I've heard the line that like that phrase is the most repeated phrase in the Torah. I think maybe even the whole Tanakh in the entire thing, because it's so important. But the fact that it's almost mistranslation proof as well, yeah, does show how that was baked into the idea. And it's also like, if convert was how you were translating ger, I don't think it actually makes sense, because they weren't converts in the land of Egypt.
No. What I think about it is a kind of grammar of reversibility. Whatever the word means, it can refer to Jews and non-Jews in the same way. Mm-hmm. That's the most important aspect of the word, in my opinion. Once it becomes ger, once it becomes convert in the rabbinic period, and you can sort of understand it because the rabbis didn't have any kind of power to be nice to immigrants. It was irrelevant. And there were proselytes, people who wanted to be part of it. One of the sort of downsides of what happened to the word, I don't know if you've interviewed Amichai Lalavi, but he has beautiful kind of set of thoughts about this particular word. The use of the word to mean convert has some downsides. I mean, in some ways it's beautiful. It's all based on the story of Ruth and Naomi. So it's got a kind of female love story at its core. But the problem is it's not reversible, right? It's not, we are gerim. It's not symmetrical, or whatever the exact term I need to find is. The other thing is it empties out this category that's a real category in ancient Israel, which is people who live among Jews, who throw in their lot with Jews in certain ways, who, for instance, it says very clearly that the laws of Sabbath are meant for Jews and people who worked for them, and the ger and the animal. And now we have this category of like, it's purely a Jewish thing. Non-Jews who live among Jews, they're too useful to, you know, turn off the light, to sell your chametz to. They're too useful to be doing what we're doing. What Amichai Lalavi says is that there are lots of people who have this kind of relationship to Judaism. They live among Jews, they're married to Jews, they have Jewish friends. And we actually know that the kingdom of Israel, not Judah, it's funny because the word Judah, you know, Judah was a kind of monoculture in a certain way compared to the kingdom of Israel. And it's very clear that the kingdom of Israel in, you know, biblical times was a multiculture. It wasn't just Jews, quote unquote. And there was a lot more kind of mixing of cultural elements. And to me, the ways that people who are married to Jews but haven't converted for one reason or another, who have Jewish children or Jewish interests or love Jewish sources, that there's no welcome for them, there's no place for them, there's no status, and Jews play a very strongly exclusivist game. I think that the word ger is a kind of opening, remembering what it once meant to some extent, I mean, without being positivistic about it and saying that we know what the word means, remembering it as a kind of open category. I mean, I could even imagine as a category in which some Palestinians would like to participate. I mean, I had a Palestinian student who was a Christian Palestinian student. I taught at a Christian divinity school, who talked about how most of her Palestinian Christian friends are like way into Jesus, like Jesus is their guy, and they don't have that much identification with the Old Testament, Hebrew Bible, because to them it seems like that's what the book that Jews use as a kind of real estate contract. Yeah. And she's like, but, you know, you look at the prophets, and the prophets are talking about people who have their land stolen from them. And I'm not ready to give up the Hebrew Bible. And, you know, I know Hebrew. I lived among Jews. So there are possibilities even for Jewish-Palestinian connection with some of these terms that we can revive that had real meaning.
Yeah, I mean, the term ger seems like it was almost made for Palestinians in that specific context.
Who are the Jews to define who Palestinians are?
But I wanted to kind of take a little bit of a step back, because you found yourself in the position where you're now directing a diaspora studies and transnational studies center. Yet you come out of translation studies, and you were also a professor in this department for the study of religion. I guess I was kind of curious how you see these different fields relating to the the discipline of diaspora studies, both like translation studies and religious studies, and how
Jewish
it's
studies.
Different, of course, in Jewish studies, and how it both owes a debt to these different departments or fields, but also sees itself as distinct and is interested in different questions.
I mean, one way of talking about that, getting that, maybe it's a bit roundabout, is that the field of translation studies and the field of diaspora studies have evolved over the last 25 years in very similar ways. Many of the people involved in diaspora studies at the outset were students of Jewish history for kind of obvious reasons. The word diaspora comes from the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, where, you know, when you talk about the migration of meaning, most people say that the word exile in the Hebrew Bible has a theological connotation and it's understood as negative. And the word diaspora, which is as close as the Greek translators could get to it, is a much more neutral term. It actually comes from an agricultural, it means to disperse, seed. So it means to strew seed. There's no judgment about it. It's like God, it's not bad. It's not bad or good. It is. It's actually a useful way to do your farming. So the field of diaspora studies, one of the people who sort of laid out the terms, who we teach in intro to diaspora studies classes, is someone named William Safran, I think his name is. And his basic model of what a diaspora is that there's a homeland, and then you're expelled from the homeland, but you maintain a connection to it. He has these kind of necessary and sufficient conditions to be considered a diaspora. So to be considered a diaspora, you have to have had a homeland. You have to have been expelled from it in some kind of traumatic way. You have to have maintained a connection to it and to all the people who similarly are connected to that homeland. Now, this is very obviously a Jewish model, and it's not surprising that it's a Jewish model. It meant that the whole field basically took Jewish experience as its way of understanding what diaspora is. As the field evolved, people were like, well, not everybody wants to go back to the homeland, or not everybody comes from a specific homeland, or what is the homeland?
Yeah, I mean, look at African diaspora.
African diaspora, or you know, I have a friend who's Ismaili Muslim who was born in Tanzania, lived in, I mean, where exactly is his, it's a very complicated question. And that's true for a lot of people. And what, you know, do they all have ties to each other? Is his ties with other Muslims? Is a tie, you know, it reminds me of Zoran Mamdani saying he was African-American. If you're going to be a diasporist, the categories have to be more multiple and flexible. And this idea that we're all going to, you know, look to Jewish studies for the basic model is becoming, you know, it's less and less true. And I used to start every diaspora studies class I taught by saying, you know, so where does the word diaspora come from? And yes, you're right. You know, if somebody knew that it came from the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, you know, pat on the head. And then someone said to me, why does it matter where it comes from? And that kind of shook me a bit. I thought, that's true. And one of the reasons why I had that thought of it's true is that diaspora translation studies has also gone from a kind of model of there's an original source And then there's a secondary translation. It's very much like the model of a homeland and a diaspora. The diaspora is lesser. The diaspora is like a little sad. The diaspora is a Xerox copy of the real thing, which is the homeland, which in translation studies, we always say, you know, there is no original. Every translation is original. Every original is a translation. We've let go of this kind of fundamental model. And for Jewish studies too, that fundamental model of the homeland that we all long to return to. What is that? For Sephardic Jews, might be Spain. For me, it's Brooklyn.
It kind of ignores the possibility for new homelands and also new diaspora. I mean, like in a real way, Ashkenazi Jews, most of us no longer live in Eastern Europe, experienced another diaspora, another exile from another homeland. And it does kind of just complicate the idea that there's one homeland that the diaspora lives in periphery in relation to.
Exactly.
And I guess that's kind of a shift from a more nation state centered understanding of diaspora to a more diaspora understanding of diaspora.
That's another thing. It's like, who ever said how many people really within this community were so identified with whatever that original homeland was, right? You know, who was there? Where did we come from? I mean, it's also this idea, there's been some critiques of Zionism that, you know, the Jews don't actually come from Palestine or that area, right? They're like, which I think is kind of irrelevant. I mean, we're talking about constructed identities, fantasy homelands, and those things are interesting and real, and whether or not they conform to some kind of model or ideal of, you know, what descent looks like, what peoplehood is. I mean, I basically think peoplehood is basically a story we tell. And we're telling different kinds of stories now.
I'm glad that you mentioned at that point this, because there has been, I mean, I guess it always was to some extent part of the discourse, but these questions about whether or not Jewish people truly have a connection to Israel and like can place all of their ancestors 40 to 50 generations back, or whether it's we're all just from Khazars in the Caucasus and they don't want you to know and they just want the Jews are lying about their origin so that they can claim Palestine. I mean, aside from like, you know, the silliness of the extremes of both arguments, it really doesn't matter. It really shouldn't matter in terms of what we understand the current geopolitical situation to be. You know, well, you mentioned about there being the various points of diaspora. I personally feel much more attached to where I know my ancestors came from, which is partially, you know, Eastern Latvia and Northwestern Belarus, the latter of which I can't travel to right now, even though I really would want to. And so I feel much more connected to that than, you know, looking back at the history of 2,000 years and the yearning for Zion or such. But that doesn't also mean that someone who converts to Judaism, therefore, then their descendants have this connection and they see the land of Israel as this big part of their history and their community and their culture. Of course, they have a connection to it that they feel. That it's completely legitimate to look at it that way because it's said with all these, you know, communal and cultural and historical ties. And so these sort of points that try to build on basing it that my history is better than your history, or this is the only correct one, a lot of this is really just like nationalist drivel and propaganda that really shouldn't belong in a non-nationalist setting that tries to build on these ideas in this way. So I was also interested to hear a bit about what diasporism means in terms of actual institutions or understanding of diaspora as not just a set of ideas that people talk about, but actual implementations in practice, both in the academic and the non-academic settings. It's one thing, you know, for two guys to have a podcast, but for actual institutes and academics and, you know, brick and mortar to be able to discuss these things and, you know, develop not just within this like theoretical world, but having an actual impact. This is something that has grown in relevance in recent decades, but also means different things to different people. So what do you think that situation is right now in regards to this academic and non-academic barrier.
Yeah. When I started teaching in diaspora studies, I saw it as a little bit of, there were very few Jewish studies students, even though we had two Jewish studies faculty in diaspora studies, both of us Yiddishists, surprise, surprise, Anna Sternschies, who's a scholar of Soviet Jewry, and me. What I taught in diaspora studies was kind of separate from Jewish studies, and I didn't have many Jewish studies students, as I said. And I even, I think, tried to downplay it because it seemed to me as if what the students were interested in was the basically Palestinians. There's also students that are very interested in Roma and like huge amounts of interest in those diasporas. And the Yiddishists that I knew at Toronto didn't take this class. And one of the things I've decided to do since I've become chair, director, is to really try to bring Jewish studies into diaspora studies, which means revising, backing away from the model where the Jewish studies experience, the Jewish experience is the basic model for understanding what a diaspora is, and moving to a more flexible way of thinking about what diaspora is, and also addressing the question that you talked about, Zach, which is what is diasporism? What is diasporism historically and what is it today? And how can an academic center help students who are wrestling with what are the ways of being Jewish that are not Zionist, for the most part, is, I guess, a quick and easy way of thinking about what we're talking about, but that have some content, that are not just like a critique of Zionism, not that there's anything wrong with a critique of Zionism, Lord knows. What else is there? This way that diaspora studies might help provide a kind of substance and content to what otherwise felt like a kind of thin political affiliation. And that's what I'm really hoping to do at DTS this year. There are certainly just many, many students that are looking for that. And I think they haven't thought to come to DTS to find it. But so I'm planning on bringing, you know, Mindel Cohen, who teaches at the Yiddish Book Center. I think she runs the Yiddish Book Center, who does like a deep dive of what are the origins of the term Deutschkeit, this Yiddish word that I'm sure you know about, that's here-ness.
I have it around my neck.
Deutschkeit is the slogan of, I would say, young Yiddishist leftist. And yet the history is a little fuzzy. Like, we have this idea, it comes from the Bund. So we're going to find out. In other words, let's figure this out. To find out that it's not an ancient, you know, term, but that it really, it's fine, right? We no longer are so taken by the original, right? The homeland, right? Whatever it is, we'll figure it out. We'll give it some substance using whatever tools we have, including figuring out what anti-Zionism looked like in religious circles, in previous generations, and today, thinking about what other forms of anti-statism there were. Jewish Yiddishist anarchism is a very rich load to mine.
There is a whole world of Yiddish anarchism that even included some non-Jews like Rudolf Rocker, who were just like in the spaces and were so immersed and embraced by these communities that even non-Jews could be part of them as long as they were willing to kind of learn to speak the language.
What does Yiddish anarchism look like? What does Jewish anarchism look like? There were Orthodox socialists. What does that look like in practice? What does a progressive social structure look like? One of my aims at DTS is to bring Jewish studies back to diaspora studies, help Yiddishists understand that this is a kind of somewhat academically lacking aspect of contemporary leftist culture. And I'm no expert, but I know some people who are. And, you know, I have a speaker's budget, and I want to get the word out there that we're taking diasporism seriously, not just diaspora, but diasporism. And we're trying to figure out its history. I guess it's history and its contours and its usefulness, etc.
I'm very happy that this question of what Deutschkeit is going to be looked at in more detail. I remember looking at one academic paper, and I don't remember who the author is, that specifically doesn't tie the etymology of Deutschkeit back to the Bund, but something different, though I can't remember it now. Interestingly, Zionist movements in the early 20th century had their own equivalent to what they understood Deutschkeit to be, and they had a German word for it, which was Gegenwartsarbeit, work in the current, which they saw as saying that even though we have far-fledged political ideas that may be completely different to our current situation, we nevertheless live in the here and now, and therefore we need to concentrate on what is in the here and now, and prepare for maybe the future. And so there are all these aspects that come with Deutschkeit. The ones that I've been forever taking to write my next article for Der Spectre, which is about Deutschkeit. And there's this sort of this high aspect. I've been sort of differentiating it as high Deutschkeit, which talks about these grand ideas of self-determination on the national scale. And then there's more the question of low Deutschkeit, which speaks about the urbanist aspect of actual, you know, ground-to-ground communities and the Jewish street and this whole question. And then there's also the question of Deutschkeit in the matter of time. And this is something that was brought to me by a chaver of mine in Vienna, that Deutschkeit in terms of here-ness also implies not being lost in the past or lost in the future, and actually being rooted in our current conditions.
I mean, it's interesting because I wear a Deutschkeit necklace all the time, and I've brought it, like, I work a service job, I interact with ordinary, random people, and sometimes they ask about it, which I'm like, oh, cool, I get a little chance to impart some Jewish wisdom. But when I've brought up Deutschkeit as here-ness, it's almost more common that people would be like, oh, so like focusing on the now rather than the geographic here. And it's very curious that that is almost more common when I'm talking to random people, Joe Schmo on the street, they just kind of jump to the now temporal element rather than the spatial here-ness, which to me has always been more central.
Also a very, very interesting question of translating Deutschkeit into different languages and different concepts. The translation of Deutschkeit into Polish, which is the word tutejszość that we use, has a very, very interesting history. And I won't get into it maybe too much right now, because I also wanted to focus on something else, this question of an alternative and something to give in this sense. Diasporism is not the same as anti-Zionism. And I don't just mean this in terms of, you know, one is more radical, one is less radical than the others, one is more left, one is more right. One has a positive vision, or in terms of a positive outlook, what it supports. One has a negative, what it opposes.
I think it's important to say that's also not necessarily like a value judgment, because I think it's important to say that like anti-Zionism is a part of many people's diasporism, and that these aren't necessarily in contradiction at all. They're just different terms that have different focuses.
They're not mutually exclusive at all, but what it means is that there needs to be, if one is to look at diasporism, or whether it be drawing from various different traditions, I most identify with the socialist diasporist tradition, one of many, again, that exist, but there needs to be something sort of meat to it, and not just resistance to the status quo. And as much as that is difficult right now with the ongoing genocide, it is also something that is needed. And sometimes I feel that there was an Instagram post about this by one of our previous guests from Le Choule Saint-Ouen. I see from my vantage point of Europe and Poland that in some ways there is this critique that is made often of Zionist organizations that they center Israel in terms of Jewish life, and they ignore diaspora. But in some practical ways, I see sometimes that Zionist organizations or movements with a Zionist outlook, actually, they in some ways pay more attention towards building actual existing communities and organizations around the world in ways in which there haven't yet been diasporist responses to. There's been critiques of the status quo, but there hasn't been an alternative practical outlook on them and the kinds of institutional connections that are needed to go from the theory around that to reality. And obviously this is a work in progress. This is not something that any individual person can do, but it is necessary to think about, because if the question is that diasporism pays attention to diaspora, and then most of the diasporist discussions are still rooted in, you know, what's going on over there, then that's, there's something that's missing, and that's something that needs to be pointed out if we are to make improvements.
In some iterations or some conceptions, I think probably many, if not all, diasporism includes Israel. I mean, if we're talking about a story that Jews are a kind of family, cousins, people, then a lot of us are there. In the same way that Israelism is about the ways in which people grow up in America, they're not absolute oppositions, and it's not just about there and here. You know, as you're saying, I agree. And a diasporism is, you know, a diasporism which heavily centers questions of family, of Jewish family, the way Danny Boy Arens does, for instance, certainly doesn't, you know, create a strong line, a strong division between Jews in some place called the diaspora and Jews in a place called Israel. Israel is a diaspora from within a different sort of conception of diaspora. I think many people feel it that way.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that Rabbi David Cooper brought up when I met him in Palestine and then later we interviewed him, this was like a year and a half ago, is that we shouldn't conceive of Israel as separate from the diaspora. We shouldn't have a binary of diaspora and Israel. We should just see it as part of the diaspora. And actually that is so important to help us really understand what an alternative might look like. Because if there is going to be an alternative, non-territorial, Jewish autonomous institution that we need to be building, like if that is to exist, it is by definition going to have a large presence within Palestine. It's important to see the way that any just settlement in Palestine, Israel, is going to involve, of course, Palestinians' right of return, Palestinians getting reparations and justice, but also negotiating what Jewish autonomy and Jewish self-determination looks like beyond Zionism. Because right now, in so many people's minds, Jewish self-determination is siloed into Israelism, is siloed into this support for a nation state. And if we are to really undermine and disentangle and deconstruct Zionism, we need to kind of have that other alternative. And it needs to be clear on how that relates to the actual question of Palestine.
We're not talking about just, you know, erasing the presence of Jews in that part of the world.
I wanted to kind of move. We previously, when we spoke, just preliminary to this conversation, we talked a lot more about translation theory and translation studies and what it might do in terms of helping us understand, like, translating societies and helping build meaning between communities. And I think that's something that's so core to diasporism and something I'd love to go into. And kind of transition to that, it just has made me think of a couple quotes. A quote that I've read in R.B. Kitaj's Second Diaspora Manifesto from someone else. And the quote is simply, "Our homeland, the text." And I really, really like that quote because, Judaism as a religious tradition is a text-based tradition, first and foremost. Of course, it's something that is always done in community with others, but it's a text-based tradition. We have the Torah, we have Tanakh, we have the Mishnah, Gemara, all the Talmud. And of course, when you think of our homeland, the text, it kind of rubs against nationalism simply because it asserts that something other than land could be our homeland. But also, in certain senses, we can read anything as the text. I mean, I took one linguistics course during my time in my undergrad, and we talked about literacy and language acquisition and talked about how we can also talk about other forms of literacy beyond just simply reading words, like cultural literacy, media literacy. And I guess sort of thinking about how do you understand our homeland, the text, as relating to your understanding of translation as well as Jewishness? And then I'd love to just go into some of that idea around polysystems and broadly understanding cultural systems, essentially, and how we can better contextualize, better understand and visualize and model the complexity that is the Jewish diaspora or any cultural society and community.
Thinking about what it means to have a certain kind of Jewish cultural literacy in our homeland, the text, that's part of it. the way in which it's sometimes described, there's like an amazing book by Yuri Sliskin. One of the things I love about this book is that it really, a lot of books about Jews, Jewish history, Jewish culture, tend to view Jews as kind of unique. And I think the first sentence of Yuri Sliskin's book is, there was nothing unique about the Jewish situation. Every society has at least two kinds of people. Any kind of advanced society, many have more. And one kind is the landed people, the people who own land, who work the land. And the other kind is the people who are the go-betweens. He calls them the Apollonians and the Mercurians. The go-betweens, there's a whole range of occupations that they fill. They're merchants, they're travelers. They do all the stuff that isn't about planting stuff. They're the doctors, they're the magicians, they're the translators. And this applies to Jews in Europe and in other places. They're the kind of the landless people who do certain kinds of work. But it also applies to Chinese in Indonesia and Lebanese in South America, Indians in South Africa. There are all these, my Muslim friend who's Ismaili, it's a very Mercurian culture. They are the translators in some sense. They translate, they bring manufactured goods from the big cities to the farmers. They're in the marketplace. They do this kind of mediation. Mm-hmm. One of the things that Sliskin says is in the modern period, everybody becomes a kind of Mercurian. And then the Jews go back to the land. There's this weird reversal. And the stereotypes, which Sliskin says are true, which is, it's a very punk book. And one of the things he says is that all the stereotypes are true. And he says the stereotypes are that the Mercurians are smart and that the Apollonians, the farmers, are strong. Strong but dumb, weak but smart. And then he talks about these people, again, not only Jews, but Jews. He says, why did Jews become the most famous of these Mercurians? Because they were the Mercurians of Europe. That's his kind of simple answer. The Mercurians typically have, he says, often have a kind of scriptural identity. It's something that keeps them apart. They're kind of their high culture that tells them that they shouldn't marry or eat with or have sex with their customers, basically.
Sounds almost like Christian monks and Christian clerics.
Yeah, except that in the case of Jew, the difference being that at least in the story that Jews tell, it's true of all Jewish men. The way he describes this culture is it's typically trilingual, which is, so Mercurians have these kinds of talents, which they no longer do in the case of Jews, but they have their sacred scriptural identity, which is how famous they are in their own minds. They're the chosen people or whatever. And then they have a kind of language of a vernacular that they use, which is a kind of Jewish variation or a Mercurian variation of the local tongue. So that's Yiddish in this case, their own like kind of language. And then they have the language that they share with their non-Jewish co-territorialists, whoever they live among. And that this, it's actually really typical of Mercurians all around the world to have these three types of cultural literacy. I mean, obviously, literacy in Hebrew is pretty rare. It was always pretty rare among Jews, among rabbinic Jews. And, you know, as you said, most, I mean, Jews are now rabbinic Jews with very few exceptions. That's the ancestral line. And it begins in diaspora. And it's very clear that Hebrew as a sacred tongue only arises after anybody's actually speaking Hebrew. Hebrew is mentioned in the Bible to talk about the language that the riffraff speak in the streets of Jerusalem, of Judea. This idea of a sacred tongue is supposed to be this language that you don't speak. And then the intimate language that you can converse among yourselves, this kind of intimacy that keeps the kind of distance between Jews and non-Jews, which Sliskin thinks is a kind of economic strategy, that the ways in which you make money is you know, basically capital, which means extracting a kind of surplus value from goods. And if you're going to extract surplus value from goods, then you better not be like good friends with the people producing the goods or whatever that is. And then this language that you need because you're living among these people, and that this is a way of describing who these people are linguistically. And this is why, I mean, one of the things I say about, in terms of what Jewish translation is as opposed to other forms of translation, let's say Apollonian translation, is that Jewish translation is always up, down, or in, out. There's no like French and German, two equals side by side at a border where you translate from one to the other. For Jews, it's always like from the inside to the outside or the outside to the inside. Or it's from the sacred language to the vernacular or the vernacular to the sacred. Or those are the directions. There's no simple, this is the structure of Jewish cultural life up until the 20th century, let's say. And now we're living in a place, what we're starting to feel is the lack of a language of Jewish intimacy, and also the lack of a language by which, a lack of a structure for affiliations between Jews and people similarly placed, right? I mean, the kind of the anarchist vision, the mutual aid vision. I think that's what Yiddish is supposed to be doing now. It's no longer the language where you talk about non-Jews. It's also the language in which you identify with other minorities, other marginalized groups, other, you know, Black Lives Matter, which is why you see all these Black Lives Matter posters in Yiddish. I mean, one of the things I'm interested in is what does Yiddish signify on a poster for someone who's not using it in their everyday life? And one of the strange things about Yiddish is that it now signifies a kind of affiliation across Jewish boundaries with Blacks in America or workers around the world, right? Arbeiter von alle Völker vereinigt sich. So there's a kind of weird tension within this.
Can you translate that Yiddish sentence you just said?
It's workers of the world unite, which every time I think of it, I always think about how the socialist cemetery in Queens, where Shalom Aleichem is buried and various other Yiddish writers, actually has the gate over around the entrance of the cemetery. It says, Arbeiter von alle Völker vereinigt sich. And it's a cemetery. And right. So what does Yiddish signify in this moment if it's not an actual vernacular, is sort of both a language of Jewish intimacy and identity outside of, that's not caught up in Israelism, and an affiliation across similarly diasporic or marginalized groups?
Well, that's a very big question regarding the Jewish left today. If you go back 100 years, the reason as to why the Bund and other organizations like it and other institutions similar to it ideologically supported Yiddish was because it was the common language of the working Jewish masses. Yiddish is not the language of the common working Jewish masses anywhere anymore. Whatever we think of that, is that the rationale? Are you trying to turn back the clock with Yiddish today? As a Yiddishist myself, not a very good Yiddish speaker, I think that there is relevance to Yiddish and other Jewish diaspora languages, but that rationale has to be different, or at least it has to be adapted in these ways.
There's a whole world of literature, of plays, of music, some of which is still being produced and made today, that is, if you don't have any way to access it, like it's effectively lost. And that's a huge tragedy when it comes to actually engaging with existing Jewish culture, because it limits our understanding of it to Hebrew culture or to religious culture, rather than this entire corpus of Yiddish literature, music, plays, and the like, that I think has a lot of relevance in terms of us, where we choose to center our Jewishness and our Jewish identities, whether it's in religion. And I'd be curious to hear how you feel about this, Naomi, as well, as someone that comes out of a more traditionally religious background. Whether that's in religion, whether that's in like the languages and cultures of our ancestors, or if it's just kind of something new that's focused solely on politics or whatever.
Which again, that goes back to the question of institutions, because Yiddishists know each other well all around the world. Yiddish institutions don't do a very good job cooperating on larger projects. The Yiddishist projects in Germany or Britain or Austria or the United States or Israel, Poland, whatever, everybody knows someone who participates in the other ones. But there's not much more that comes out of that apart from the interpersonal. And as for religious institutions, I mean, even for people who are not religious themselves, the fact that religious institutions have a certain formula that exists and again is made out of, you know, brick and mortar places that you can actually see on a map, go to, meet other peoples in, that makes synagogues a very, very important cultural place, even for people who are not necessarily themselves religious.
When you talk to Yiddishists now, it seems as if a lot of people are interested in Yiddish because it provides a kind of prehistory for the Jewish left. But there are other ways of thinking about what Yiddish has to offer that were, you know, in the last 20, 30 years of my own life, were just as important. And when you talk about religion, so for instance, you know, at some point in the, I don't know, the 70s or the 80s, Jewish feminism was all about, you know, what do we do with these patriarchal prayers? And what do we do with the sexually segregated synagogue? And what do we do with this religion that we've inherited? And there were all these attempts to, you know, create new versions of prayers in which the matriarchs are remembered along with the patriarchs. And this was seen as a revolutionary thing to do, right? And if there hadn't been, I don't know if you want to say, there hadn't been a Holocaust, if there hadn't been cultural amnesia, if we hadn't lost Yiddish, then many of these feminists who were creating different versions of the prayer book would have known that their own grandmothers, their own great-grandmothers, had a liturgy in which only the matriarchs, you know, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah, only the matriarchs were mentioned. The patriarchs, you know, sometimes made an appearance. And there was a whole entire liturgy that in some ways is much preferable to the synagogue rituals insofar as you speak directly to God as an individual versus the collective first person. They came along with all kinds of like folk traditions, like, you know, cemetery practices and making candles and a whole way of being a religious Jewish woman that was basically forgotten. And instead, we're like reinventing the wheel, and it's trying to get a piece of a pie that's already missing most of its flavor and, you know, going to rabbinical school and doing this and like, yes, let's study Talmud. I remember hearing about these trinas, and my own mother said trinas. You know, it doesn't even go that far back, this amnesia. She just didn't pass it along to me because I had a Beis Yaakov education. I remember being a graduate student and hearing that there's this woman, Chava Weissler, who's doing research on Yiddish women's spirituality. And like, we didn't have basic information. I think her book came out after mine. I was trying to recover this history with no tools at all. And it's like in a generation or two, it was lost, forgotten, erased. And feminism, you know, was fighting a kind of irrelevant battle. I think irrelevant battle.
I mean, I think it really speaks to the amount of, I mean, you used collective amnesia or
cultural genocide.
Yeah, honestly, in the name of assimilation and being accepted into
assimilation
whiteness
and murder.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just thinking from my own family history where like my grandparents were not taught Yiddish because Yiddish was the language that their parents would use when they didn't want the kids to understand. And it was intentionally not passed down. And I'm sure there's many reasons beyond just simply wanting to have a language that your kids don't understand. I do think a lot of it is wanting to not be seen as an immigrant, being able to be a true American that only speaks English. And I guess it just speaks to how much we've lost in the name of kind of letting ourselves fit into this mold of whiteness. And I guess just a question that it raises for me is like, does this mean that the importance of translation is even more so? If we don't really have Yiddish as a common tongue, should we be translating as much Yiddish music and plays and books into English so that they're accessible again? Or is there another way?
I mean, this is another reason that, you know, Jewish translation or translation, you know, talking about philosophical issues of meaning and how to adjudicate between two language systems, why they don't often get at the heart of what we're talking about when we talk about languages. And that when we talk about languages, we're not just talking about, you know, words on a page or in a bilingual dictionary, the emotions that are connected to it. In the case of Yiddish translation, it's you know, it's not just like, oh, let me read a textbook about how do I do dynamic translation, formal translation. We're talking about rescue. We're talking about reversing a kind of loss. We're talking about finding a way to be in the world that isn't just borrowed from other people, that isn't a thin copy of other people's culture. This is, you know, the idea that translation is a form. This is one of the things I actually talk about in my most recent book. When Freud was translated into Hebrew and to Yiddish, like beginning in 1933, the project was they're burning his books in, you know, Nazi Germany, and we must salvage him in a Jewish language. You know, if you say that my homeland is the text, then the text has a kind of life and death quality. Freud too. My homeland, the text, they're burning Freud's books in Berlin and in Tel Aviv in 1933. Somebody, you know, meets Bialik on a bus and says, we have to bring Freud home. That's maybe not a die kite kind of example, but the same kind of feeling that we have now. It's, you know, there's not much time. It isn't just for Freud's sake. It's also for my sake. It's a way to connect to, it's a way to give myself some, you know, some culture, some Jewish culture. You know, one of the translation theory of studies is one of these fields that's always absorbing other fields. And there's the field of affect theory, which
I'm familiar as well.
It's feeling, right? Translation can be full of feeling, the feeling of connection, of bringing something home, of saving something, etc.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to kind of wrap up with a little bit of a conversation on this concept of a polysystem and this idea of like a defective polysystem versus a rich polysystem and the sort of work that we need to be doing if we want to build a diasporist Jewish polysystem that can create and hold a life world for a cultural world for all. I thought when we were speaking a bit before we hit record about the history of polysystem theory and its now largely irrelevance because the original creator, Itamar Ben Zohar, is an Israeli, and you brought up that it's ultimately a casualty of intellectual boycotts on the University of Tel Aviv. But I do think there's something there to be said about what it might offer us in terms of understanding cultural worlds and cultural renaissance that we might be working towards.
Without getting too technical in terms of polysystem theory, people who've tried to conceptualize what it means to talk about richer and thinner cultures. Like I have a friend who says he doesn't want to live in anything less than a five babka town. In other words, a town where you can get five babkas. Because if you can get five babkas, then there's almost certainly a variety of schools you can send your kids to. You can always, right? It's a sign of a vibrant Jewish society. So when people talk about, you know, interwar Poland was in some ways a very awful and depressing place to be living. But the cultural systems were incredibly rich. So there were, like, in any small town, you would have an option of, you know, three or four different youth movements you could belong to, three or four kinds of Jewish schools you could send your kids to, religious, secular, you know, this kind of Zionist, that kind of Zionist, this kind of communist, that kind of communist, socialist, anarchist, whatever. It was a kind of culture in hyper-ferment. And I think that's one of the things that we feel nostalgic about, because it's so not like that in American Jewish cultures today, right? So the variety, the idea of Jewish presses of various kinds, the idea that you could be in different kinds of Jewish groups, that you would have a choice of how to educate your children. It's not just that the American Jewish society is so polarized around questions of Israel-Palestine, and I know it's like that in a lot of places. It's also that there isn't much to replace this kind of Israelism, or to supplement it if you want to do that way, or there just isn't that much. And the feeling is, well, so I grew up where it was all about, you know, Israel Independence Day and synagogue, and that was it. And what else is there? Okay, so I could be learning Talmud with queer people, like that's a big thing. I could, you know, there's these little kind of alternatives sprouting up here and there, but we still have what I guess the, if you want to call it, the secular progressive Jewish left and all the young people who are decided that they've been, you know, raised in a society, you know, they're interested in finding out what else there is to Jewishness besides what they you know, inherited from a certain period of American Jewish culture. There's not much there. Definitely go to a demonstration. But what else do you do? I mean, where do you find the ways to live a Jewish life, to make Jewish connections, to, you know, beyond the poster, beyond the demonstration? And, you know, people are trying to do it.
It is difficult to understand from today's perspective just how active people were and how participatory various movements in the Jewish community. But again, not only, just that's how politics was done back then. Yeah. Politics wasn't about just, you know, there are teams who fight. Yeah,
I mean, it was identity.
Yeah, it was about basically any single need that you could have. You know, you could have situations where the man was in the union and the woman was in the women's organization, the child was in the youth organization, and they all went to the libraries, and they were surrounded from every part of these movements. Now, from if you just compare that to today and you imagine just jumping into that, it almost seems cultish. Right? That someone could be just completely...
And there were crazy fights, and not everybody in the family was in the same movement. And
Oh, yeah.
On the other hand, we're talking about, you know, growing fascism, in which a method of the rise of authoritarianism and fascism is the destruction of civil society and the lack of mutual aid and the fact that we don't know our neighbors.
For me, what is super depressing in the current state is the lack of physical spaces. This is my favorite example just of it. But when you look at the interwar Bund in Poland, there's one memoir that illustrates this very well.
Third space, right? The space that's not home or work, but yeah, where everything happens.
There's one chapter in Bernard Goldstein's memoir, which is basically just the Central Committee met here, the sports organization met here, the soup kitchen was here, the newspaper's editorial office was here, the printers were around the corner. And it's just like this. And you compare this to the Jewish left in London or New York. And in London, 250,000 Jews, if you want to compare it to Warsaw in the interwar period, it's not that much of a difference. Maybe it's a little less in London than 250,000. But there's no spaces like that.
There was in London. There was the International Workers Educational Club that opened in the late 1880s into the 1890s. And ultimately, it tore itself apart because of political differences. But only by having a space like that was it possible for someone like Rudolf Rocker, who was a non-Jewish anarchist, to become immersed in the Jewish anarchist world and to learn Yiddish as a language of cultural radicalism.
As if the renting situation was better 100 years ago, right?
Right. Yeah, they had money. No, it's the destruction of livable lives.
Yeah. I mean, when we look at, you know, what was then and what is now, it's we shouldn't be able to build in just have this kind of nostalgia for everything great was back then. But there are some ways and some aspects to which we can draw inspiration from and work towards a better future. I will leave it at this just because it is getting very late. So I will just say thank you very much, Naomi, for your time and for these explorations. And I hope that, you know, by having conversations such as these, we can really break the barrier that sometimes exists unnecessarily, to some extent, maybe necessarily, between the academic world and whether we're talking about strictly political action or just people knowing what's going on in the most recent research. There are ways in which this can be broken down. And one of them is, of course, through the establishment of libraries and such, and academic resources that are not all locked in behind university accounts and JSTOR. And
paywalls are paywalls, EPUB, it's Sci-Hub, different paywalls.
Even without the paywalls, because you might always be able to have a university student download it for you and send it in that way. But it's also the analysis. It's also making it accessible, just because something is
open source website on Jewish diasporas. How's that?
Yeah. Let's make it happen. Yeah.
Let's do it. It's right up. It's completely in sync with my job title. So it's not even a hobby for me. It's what I've been hoping for, I actually thought that we need a bunch of books in the Center for Diaspora Studies. We need a lounge. We need space. I'm right with you that this is about you know, combating a kind of alienation and isolation. And yes, beyond the university too. So it's really inspiring to talk to you and to know that there are potential comrades out there.
Of course. And, and of course, anybody in Toronto, I'm sure there are ways of being engaged physically on site. In that
Toronto area. Had a wealth of, it had a Jewish socialist library. Now it has what's called the Free Speech Cafe, which is, has a Yiddishist bent. So there, cool. People are trying to make things like that happen.
And all of it takes work because at the end of the day, none of this is funded. One of the reasons why the Zionist poly system has the hegemony it has in the Jewish world is because that's where the money is. And we need alternative funding sources. We need to self-fund mostly for a lot of these things.
You need connections with certain amounts of power, which means older people and people with jobs of the sort that I have.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to chat with us.
And really, we should at some point wonderful. Sit around and actually have a glace latte.
Thank you.
Thank you.